So it's a real pleasure for me to be here, as I'm sure for those of you who haven't been here before, to stand on the home turf of really one of the pioneering groups in the field, led by Ingolf Sack. And I've talked to Ingolf many, many times and always wanted to visit, so it's a real pleasure to be here. I thought this would be a great topic for two reasons for the workshop. One, he probably should be an author. He totally inspired this work, and we wouldn't be doing it without his influence on it. And two, it is in the spirit of a workshop. So these are very, very preliminary results. I think my conclusion slide I'll give now is sort of stay tuned. So how do I advance this? Oh, there we go. So a little background. Again, Ingolf's group, my first notion of functional MRE came from this paper by Fellner, where they were looking at could they detect changes in elasticity, viscoelastic properties, during a functional paradigm. And they published this nice paper, did a lot of subjects. And at that time, and as they continued to, they were doing multi-frequency acquisitions. And what they showed was at the lower end of the frequency spectrum, they saw bigger differences. And so I think this prompted a conversation. I think Ingolf was on one of our students' PhD thesis defense committees at the time. We were starting to develop these poroelastic ideas using intrinsic actuation, using the natural cerebral vascular pulsations of your brain as the source of motion. And so we sort of said, hey, maybe we should try this at that sort of one hertz frequency. Could we detect this functional changes? So that was the idea. Of course, this later work by Sam Paz has gotten a lot of attention in the rodent model, working with the Cincus group to sort of show these kinds of changes in a hind limb stimulation, electrical stimulation model. I think many of you have seen that work. It was very exciting. So we had this idea that we would try to work together, that Ingolf would implement our intrinsic actuation strategy. Oh, let me say, so they did the visual cortex. So I put this in really more for me, sort of remember, okay, where is the visual cortex anywhere? Remember, it's the back of your brain. And the nice thing about it has a subcortical footprint. So it's conducive to volume acquisitions with MRE. So I think that's why it's a nice paradigm. And so we were gonna work on this. It turns out we were using Philips scanners, and we were using a pulse sequence that John Weaver was the one who recognized this intrinsic actuation idea. Could you just use a standard angiography sequence to encode the velocity profile in the brain? If you synchronize that to the heartbeat, then you could inverse Fourier transform that to get a displacement field. And we started doing this and showing, yeah, we could produce elastograms. But you know, the viscoelastic model, that momentum term gets pretty small, so you start to get into indeterminacy with a standard viscoelastic model. And as Matt McGarry showed in a paper, the fluid component starts to play a bigger role at lower and lower frequencies. So the idea was to start doing this on the Siemens scanners that Ingolf had. Unfortunately, this is a clinical sequence. You got to pay money for a clinical sequence. And he didn't have that package on the scanners they had here. So we never really quite got there. We started exchanging these multi-frequency data sets that Eli showed you, and so we continued to work together. So another fortunate thing happened. Eli's group in Sherbrooke, they put in a Philips scanner just like ours, and he had access to a clinical scientist as part of that installation from Philips, who knew a lot about the sequence development environment on a Philips scanner, much more than John Weaver did. And so this individual collapsed the time. We were running about 30 minutes, about 10 minutes per acquisition direction to get a full volumetric flow field. And this person was able to reduce that to about 10 minutes, sort of cut it in a third. I won't get into the details of that, but that enabled us to then do what Ingolf and we had talked about doing a number of years ago, to sort of acquire now these intrinsic actuation sequences on a time frame that's fairly reasonable. And here's the, so what happened, this is at Sherbrooke, the data was collected, and we met methodology. So it's a T1 standard bold sort of acquisition. And note the time scales here, so that's 30 seconds, five reps, so it's on off very quick. Find out where the visual cortex is lighting up, which is fairly robust. Then, you know, acquire the MRE, the intrinsic MRE data around that footprint. There you can see we're running about 10 minutes per acquisition, so we repeat that three times over about 30 minutes. So the time scales are a little different in terms of the activation that's going on, but nonetheless, that's what we did. So I think we've done four or five subjects, and I'll show you a little bit of that data. So it's a pattern that looks like this. I don't think that's exactly the pattern. Eli says it's a little bit daunting. Maybe some of you have experienced this sort of thing. And this is just showing the intrinsic actuation technique that we've been using at Dharma. What we like about it is you don't need any external devices. So you can tie it to any MR protocol that you want if you can get the time down. And this new sequence allows you to do that. Because, again, adding 30 minutes to a scan that's already collecting a bunch of other sequences is a lot. But getting it down to 10 makes it more feasible, and certainly even for research studies, a lot better. So this, I won't go into this. This is a lot more detail than I want to get into today, but you could look at these equations. So these are the poor elastic equations. And so on the upper top, they look pretty much, if you cut out the grad P term and that beta, you'd sort of be back to the Navier's equations. You can see as omega gets low, that momentum term starts to decrease, and so you start to get indeterminacy in the viscoelastic equations. When it's zero in a homogeneous medium, you would have true indeterminacy between the shear and lambda modulus, right? You could only, in principle, reconstruct their ratio. But you couple in this pressure field. So again, the pressure is a surrogate for the fluid flow in the system, and that probably is more important at these frequencies that are at the cardiac rate. And we do this subzone thing that Matt talked about, Eli invented it a long time ago, where you basically, you know, it's a data-rich environment, right? And Eli showed you that. There's a lot of data, which is a great thing for inversion. So you sort of piecemeal this into smaller subset versions that overlap, and you can interface them and integrate them, and there's all kinds of things you can do as Matt has shown various techniques. I think I'm going to skip this. This talks about some other stuff. So let me show you some data. I'm just going to show you a bunch of data real quickly. And again, this is very fresh. We've only been doing this since earlier this summer. So the first panel, the next sequence are going to be averages of on-off states. So this is subject AB shear modulus. So on in the middle, off on the right. And remember, it was about 10 minutes on, 10 minutes off, three times. So those are average here. And then this on the left, your left is the, that's the bold. Okay, so it's not really a one-to-one. And so these are slices. I'm going to show you anatomically coronal slices flipped up in a head supine position. So the bottom of the image ought to be lighting up. So you can't really tell too much here. Here's the lambda modulus. You do see in the off state, sort of interestingly, a change. So again, these are mean, I should say. So it's, if you sort of in your mind difference, and I'll show you some differences later, the middle and the right, you can see where you might be seeing differences. And the hydraulic connectivity. I'll just flip through a couple more real quickly. This is sort of interesting. Note on your left, sort of the partition of the brain, the two hemispheres of the brain. Lighting up in the visual cortex. Just keep that in your mind. So then we processed this some more, and Eli's group did most of this. So what we did was we looked at now the difference between the on-off state. So these are pictures of actually 1 minus P. So looking at the a t-test of differences of means. So if P were 0, that'd be a 100% confidence that you have a difference. So light is significant, and dark is not. So these are complicated, right? They're pretty detailed. You're certainly seeing light and dark spots. But if you look at the, certainly in the lambda modulus, in the first few rows where the visual cortex is lit up, you do see accentuation down there. And then if you look at the bottom rows, where it's sort of fading away, you do see that start to fade away. Again, sort of complicated distributions. I'll skip that. The hydraulic connectivity, that's even more complicated to look at. Here's the next subject. This one's interesting. You do start to see this U-type shape, again, splitting between the hemispheres. It's blurred in the shear modulus map in the middle, but it's similar in structure overall, grossly, to what you see in bold. There's again the hydraulic connectivity. That's harder to sort of sort out. And then just to sort of simplify, take one slice to relate again, in the middle, far left, the T1, then the bold actuation, then mu and lambda, just one slice sort of suggesting some actuation in the area of interest. Notice not specific, right? We're seeing it elsewhere too, and so what does it mean? Is it robust or not? Way too early to tell. Here's a couple other subjects we've done four, again, not going through all that detail. So these are very new, interesting, I think, very, very preliminary, but at least suggestive. And so we're going to keep working on it. And thanks for your attention. And thanks to Ingolf for inspiring us. And hopefully we'll get some data from you sometime. And we'll continue to see if we can mine anything out of it. So thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Keith. Are there any questions?
I'm sorry, what, say that again, I didn't catch it. That's sort of, again, I don't know who you've worked with up there, Eli, but we've not done that. So this is very basic, sort of early experiments, just using a standard paradigm, but appreciate the suggestion. Yeah, it's not all that sophisticated for sure, for starters, from the FMR point of view. Yeah.
Taking your note about preliminary, what do you think it is?
I don't know. it's enough to continue to pursue it. I'm not sure that's the best data you could get, so we've been working on just the data, doing it again. Maybe there's a better paradigm to do that would refine it. So. That would be my guess, but I don't know if that's true or not. I mean, people have speculated it could be other things. It's interesting, you know, the lambda modulus seems pretty robust, but it's in the off state. My gut reaction, that would flip, but, you know, I don't know. That we've seen that, and I should say, in all honesty, it hasn't always gone in the same direction. You know, you don't really get that in these those difference of mean things, which way it went. So, you know, it's early. It's early. I'm not running to the bank, but I think it's interesting enough that we will run and pursue it a little bit further. So, and we will. Yeah. So, yeah, Ingolf.
So measure time was 10 minutes.
Yeah. So the time scales are completely different.
And during that 10 minutes, you continuously.
Yeah, you're continuously looking at that, so whether, you know, how that impacts the response, I think, is
yeah. Do you think there is saturation?
Oh, is that not true?
It was 5 minutes for on and then 5 minutes off.
So oh, is it five?
Continuous visual stimulation for 5 minutes and then off for 5 minutes.
Repeated three times?
Repeated three times.
Do you have any idea about saturation effects?
I'm sorry?
About saturation effects.
Oh, yeah, I can't imagine. If I'm looking at that thing, you're probably, I mean, you know, I just think.
What is a normal paradigm in fMRI, I think?
Yeah, it was like 30 seconds, right?
Because I'm working with a guy who does fMRI at Sherbrooke, and he was saying that they have started visual stimulation and
But could this then be 2 minutes or so delayed and reaching into the off acquisition?
Yes,
to make it maybe more responsive, therefore you see maybe lambda modulus the off experiment, signal.
Yeah, this is our first sort of cut at it. We now have a way to get data at low frequency, working with the collaborators that Eli's got. So totally agree. So we're open to any suggestions in that regard. So I'm certainly a novice in the fMRI space, but I mean, we you know, the bold response is minutes, right? It's not like electrical activation or something. So, but yeah, I would think if you're sitting there watching, I can just imagine being the subject, you're saturated from a mental point of view, I'm sure. So what that does to your brain, I don't know.
Keith, can I ask a question regard to the mathematical aspect of this inversion?
Yeah, I kind of grew.
So when we apply the curl operator to get rid of the compression wave and we do this direct inversion and look at the storage modulus, which is the real part of the complex shear modulus, negative values are not physically meaningful, so it's always positive. How is that with the lambda modulus? Can it be, it's somehow related to compression and dilatation, so can it be negative, or?
We don't, I'll ask these guys who actually do it day to day. We typically don't see negative, do we? It gets small, it gets low, so I think it's a slot parameter in some ways. You put a bound on it. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
It will go negative.
What's that?
It will go negative sometimes in noisy areas if you let it.
If you don't force the positivity, yeah.